The following audio is from North Life Church in Fort McMurray, Alberta. More information is available at northlifechurch.ca.
All right, Japan is a Shinto country. That's the name of their religion. It's very similar to Buddhism. In fact, there's at some points, there's really no distinguishing between the two. And part of the reason why I was in Asia, in addition to being there for my vacation, was to also set up a teaching series that I'm going to have with the young adults in a few weeks here, doing teaching about world religions. So Shinto was one of them, right? And so I was doing my research, I was doing some videotaping and all that stuff, and like I said, it was great to be there on New Year's Day, not just because the festival had a lot of street food and all that stuff that I really enjoyed personally, but I also had a chance to really interact with and see the Japanese people at their Sunday best, essentially, right? Maybe their Easter best. That's, to them, New Year's Day or New Year's Eve is their Easter. That's their big religious thing. And I always thought that Shinto was this kind of, well, it's more of a superstitious religion, right? When they pray, they're not praying, they're wishing, right? And they have a lot of these little tokens and things that they do that are connected to wishes, which, I mean, in one sense, yes, that's what our prayers are. They're our wishes to God, right? But to them, there's no concept of this kind of one monotheistic creator God of the world. And so there's no sense of praying to that God. To them, when they're praying, they're wishing, just randomly wishing into the cosmos or into the world, right? So that, to me, was my understanding of Shinto. And I was really surprised in Aomori when I came across, so there's this main shrine where most people would go to do their prayers. So they would go up to there. They have a bell. They would ring the bell. They would clap twice, they would do their prayer, and then they would bow and throw some money into a little pot. And that's what I normally see in like manga and anime, you know, the Japanese things, that the Japanese cultural items that we would know. But then I was surprised to see, just off to the side, there are two little pagodas there that were also shrines, but they are specifically dedicated to two people. So this is where kind of the Buddhist influence comes in here. They're not, it wasn't a Buddhist shrine. It was definitely a Shinto shrine. But there's this Buddhist influence where they took two revered individuals, essentially, and they erected shrines to these two people. And so on New Year's Day, I was walking around and I saw people doing the same thing. So here, there's the main Shinto shrine where they do their prayers to the cosmos. And then over to the side, they also do their prayers to these two revered figures, right? So wheels were turning in my head, and I was trying to figure things out and understand what was going on. And maybe 2 weeks later, I was in Kuala Lumpur. Kuala Lumpur, I know, is in Southeast Asia, but you might be surprised, it's Malaysia. You'd be surprised to find out that it actually has the largest Hindu shrine outside of India. Largest Hindu shrine outside of India. It's a place called the Batu Caves. And I went there and I was exploring. It was really hot, so I didn't do much more exploring than I really wanted to. I was really tired. And there, the Hindu idols that I saw there, I was more used to seeing. Do you understand? You know, the little Hindu idols, just the elephant with tons of arms and all that stuff. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make fun of it. I'm just trying to explain. I really wish I'd gotten some pictures up. But basically, that's the shrines of the Hindu gods that I'm more used to. So that's what you would probably associate with idolatry. Basically, they have all these idols, and there are tons of them. I went into this cave. So the Batu Caves, there's two sections. I didn't go up the stairs, which are like 180 steps. And I was like, nah, not at 30 degrees. No way. But down below, there was a little cave there. And so I went through, and it was actually kind of the history of, I don't know if it was a history of Hinduism, period, or if it was a history of Hinduism in Malaysia, right? Well, not history, it was their mythology, the mythology of Hinduism in Malaysia. And so you walked around and you saw all these shrines all over the place. Now I was very used to seeing. And then finally, another place that I went to was in Phuket, Thailand. And there I went to their big Buddha, which literally was just that. It was the big Buddha, like this huge Buddha sitting on top of the building that they were at. And there was a big staircase where you walked up and you saw the Buddha. And like I said, Buddhism and Shinto, I always thought was this kind of, you know, more superstitious, not really, they don't really have a god that they worship or anything like that. And in fact, there was a shrine or there was a little explanation of Buddhism that they had at the very front of the building. And it was talking about how, yeah, we don't do theology. We're more about enlightenment and all of this stuff. And as I was walking in, I very quickly realized that that really was not the case. That the main entrance towards the staircase. So you went in this way. You went in the main entrance, and the staircase was here to get to see the big Buddha. Was just lined with same thing, idols all over the place, right? And I thought that was really the biggest, the most striking disconnect for me to what they say they are versus what they really are, right? Because here they're saying they're all about enlightenment. There's no theology for them, right? Theology, by the way, is just when you think about God. When you think, when you argue, when you say something about God, you're doing theology right there, right? So for these people, they don't do theology. You know, they don't have the big, thick textbook for systematic theology that I read through cover to cover just for you guys, right? They don't do that. And yet they have all these idols, tons and tons of idols. Like I was shocked by how many idols they had. Like I really thought I was going to go see the big Buddha and that was it. The big Buddha was all I would see. But all over the place, inside their complex, all around the side of their buildings, all the side on the entrance there, all these other statues, not just Buddhas. Like you get to see Buddhas, but just different kinds of idols and other statues. And it occurred to me that really, no matter how irreligious you think you are, no matter what you think you say you do in your religion, whether it's a secular religion, right? Today is the Super Bowl, of course, and probably one of the most religious events in the United States of America. They realize it or not. For all these people who worship and revere these players and these teams. I'm not saying that that's widespread. There's a lot of that going on probably, right? But probably one of the most religious Sundays in all of America when the worshiping and the revering of these teams are going on. Whether you're irreligious, you're secular, or you consider yourself a religion or not, there's this concept and idea of idolatry that is just so ingrained in us, in human beings. In fact, it's so ingrained that, I'm blanking on his name now. That someone, very important, called our hearts a factory of idols. We are a factory of idols. That's what our hearts are. We create idols out of everything and anything other than God. Other than God. And I thought that was so striking and so important to see for me, especially as I began this world religion kind of study, to just understand what it was like for other religions. And I was debating with myself whether I would say this or not. Honestly, just to again hammer on the point of how clear this is to us, or at least to me, about another religion. Then I went to the Philippines, of course, which is where I'm from, and Philippines is an 80% Philippine population is 80% Catholic, which is Christian, right? But one of the big things in the Philippines is the veneration of Mary, the Mother of God, right? The Mother of Jesus. And usually in most Filipino households, most Filipino Catholic households, the way this would take form in is a statue of Mary somewhere in their house. Like it would be elevated, it would just be on just one statue of Mary right there. Right? And that's usually what you would see. It's probably in a little area that most visitors wouldn't see it all that often, unless you were more religious, then you would have that, and you would have a picture of the Last Supper as well. right? And then if you were really religious and you were a little bit richer, which my grandparents are kind of there, right? Then you would have a little cabinet full of these. Then you would have Mary and a saint and something else or whatever. But Matt, what is that? Catholic religion, which is a Christian religion, which for the most part historically believes what we believe because of this addition of the veneration of Mary, whatever that means, there's idols in their household. Right? Just to hammer on this point, this is a Christian nation. They pray to our God. They pray to Jesus. They just also happen to pray to Mary. And I'm trying to be as sensitive as I am here because I know there's a lot of Filipinos here and a lot of you have Christian, Catholic family still. Maybe you're still consider yourself Catholic, right? I don't. I became a believer in Jesus Christ when I was 6 years old. My family, my mom, my dad, my brother were all non-Catholic. In my family, though, my extended family, we're the only ones who are Protestant. So that's a little bit of a touchy subject, I know, even for me. So that's what the world is outside of Christianity, whether you're secular or you're religious, whether sometimes even if you're Christian, you consider yourself Christian or not, that's what the world is. It's full of idolatry. And so what I wanted to do today was to go through this passage, Genesis 22, and talk about what true worship really is so that we can start to begin to distinguish between the two. Distinguish between the worship of idols and the worship of the one true Creator God. And so that's what we're going to do in Genesis 22, and we're going to very quickly link that up to Romans 12. So if you have your Bibles, just open up to Genesis 22. I'm just going to read maybe like 8 verses or so. That's all we need for this morning. 22 verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. And offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took 2 of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place which God had told him. On the 3rd day, Abraham lifted up his eyes, and saw that the place was, saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and said, and laid it out on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. So that's the beginning of this story that maybe many of us are probably familiar with, right? God comes down and in Abraham's dream, I guess, or something, tells Abraham he needs to go to this mountain named Moriah and he needs to sacrifice as a burnt offering. And you understand what that means, right? As a burnt offering, his son Isaac. That means death. He needs to kill Isaac, burn him as an offering. And that's what God is requiring of Isaac, of Abraham in this passage right here. Now we know the end of the story, of course. That didn't go through. Abraham was about to strike Isaac to kill him, right? And God says, no, stop. I mean, it was a test. I now know that you love me more than Isaac, right? So he provided a ram, a substitute to offer instead of Isaac. But that's beside the point. That's part of the story. But for our study of worship this morning, I just want to cover the very first few passages here. There's very 3 basic points that I want to understand about worship. And the first thing is this, that worship is initiated by God. Worship is initiated by God. So as you can see in this passage here, God was the one who called out to Abraham. Abraham, he said, and Abraham responds, Here I am. And then God gives his instructions for what he expects him to do, right? This isn't the only place that this has been happening. Genesis 22, we're about 10 chapters in to the story of Abraham, pretty much every interaction with God starts with God calling out Abraham, right? God initiates the worship of Abraham. And that is so key a point for us to understand, because when it comes to idolatry, we need to be able to distinguish between idols of either dead wood or metal or whatever it is that these idols are, the literal idols, or maybe some celebrity that you worship who doesn't even know your name. Maybe you got retweeted once or twice, and oh, this feels great, but no, they don't know you. There's no relationship there between the two of you, right? They're not ever going to initiate something with you, right? That's what false worship is. That's what idolatry is. And it really is a folly. Isaiah 44 is one of the best places for me to have ever seen this. It's really incredible, the strength of the language that Isaiah has here about idolatry. In verse 9, you don't have to turn there. It says this, "All who fashion idols are nothing, and the things that they delight in do not profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble. Let them stand forth. They shall be terrified. They shall be put to shame together." Here's the key part. "The ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers, and he works it with his strong arms." There's someone is needed to create an idol, right? Again, whether it's a physical, literal idol, something that you fashion, you carve, or whatever it is, you need to create that. That's what it is. Idols are created things. "He becomes hungry and his strength fails, and he drinks no water and he faints." So here the craftsman, who's the creator of the idol, he actually gets tired of creating an idol and he faints. Right? That's the folly of idolatry. It's dependent on man's strength. "The carpenter stretches out a line. He marks it out with a pencil. He shapes with a plane and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into a figure of a man with the beauty of a man to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses cypress tree, or an oak, lets it grow strong amongst the tree in the forest. He plants a cedar, and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for the man. He takes part of it and warms himself. He kindles fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it." Do you see again here another folly of idolatry? One part of the wood, one part of this tree that was created as idol, probably made into something else. Here, it was made into the fuel for the fire so that he can warm himself and get something to eat, right? And then the other part of the wood somehow becomes something that you worship. How does that work? Who chooses which of the wood is divine and which of the wood is not, right? And just like celebrities, and again, I want to hammer... Celebrities, I don't know about celebrities. It's one of those things that's so clear to us that people worship them, right? You know, Justin Bieber, all his Twitter fans. I don't know what it is about Twitter today. Justin Bieber is revered and worshipped by hundreds and thousands of mostly young girls, right? But to the rest of the world, he's this weird kid that you never have wanted anything to do with. How did that happen? Who chose him to be divine in one case and to be absolutely hated in another case? You remember back in the day where the United States was like, "Oh, can you take Justin Bieber back?" And all that. So how did that work out? Right? And same thing goes with our sports team. Right? Our sports team are both revered and hated at the same time. I absolutely hate LeBron James. He's annoying. Right? And yet my next door neighbor here, he's his favorite. Not really a favorite, right? Kind of. He's from Ohio. Cleveland, right? I'm from Toronto, so that's our thing, right? So how does that work out? How does LeBron James become a hero, an idol to one, and a hated figure for another? This is the folly of idolatry. It's entirely up to the person either worshiping or hating to decide what that idol is, or what that thing is, an idol or an object of hate, of scorn, right? That cannot be a God That cannot be the God. There's absolutely no way that something like that can be our God. And so that's the difference between our holy creator God and the idols that we create for ourselves, right? Our holy creator God will call us. He calls us, right? And in one part of our theology that this church generally agrees with, it's called the 5 points of Calvinism. One point of that is irresistible grace, right? Irresistible grace. If God calls you, you cannot resist the grace that he's going to offer you. And that's actually amazing. It's a great and wonderful thing. So Abraham was called by God to worship. Secondly, Abraham immediately obeyed God, right? So God calls Abraham. Abraham says, here I am. God explains what he wants Abraham to do. And remember what that was. He wants him to kill his son, turn him into a burnt offering, right? And what does Abraham do, right? I procrastinate on lesser things, right? I'm not going to lie. I was still working on this sermon last night, right? I'll procrastinate on lesser things. And here Abraham is taking a direct command from God, and he obeys him immediately. He prepares the wood. He saddles up his donkey. He goes and selects two of his probably more trusted young men, right, young servants, because pretty out there thing that he's expected to do right now, right? He goes and selects two of his young men, and he tells them, we're going on a journey, right? Abraham immediately obeys God despite the drasticness, the greatness of this commandment that God asks of him. And that is also the expectation for us. But here's the great thing about God. He will not give us something to do that we cannot handle. He will not tempt us beyond something that we can't handle, right? And like I said, we're chapter 22 here. We're 10 chapters into this story of Abraham hearing God's word and obeying. This is years and years and years and years of a relationship and trust between God and Abraham to bring God to this point of telling Abraham to sacrifice his son, right? It's an expected thing. We are expected to obey God when we are called by God. But first of all, if we don't obey immediately, he'll keep calling. He'll keep asking. He'll still be there. And that's his grace. That's not nagging or anything like that. That's his grace for us, not to just leave us, set us off aside and cast us off. Or he will do it within the bounds of what we can believe and accomplish in him based on the depth of our belief in him. Right? Abraham is very mature in his faith at this point. But God will come to you where you are in your faith, in the level of your faith and level of your maturity. And he will ask you of those things. Might be something small. I know my one of the biggest things for me, just one of the biggest, themes of my life has been finances over the past 10 years, really. And there, one of the biggest things has been tithing or not tithing, right? And I used to play games, honestly. I'll just say that straight up. I used to play games with God. I'll say, oh, well, I'm serving so much in church anyways. It's 12 bucks an hour, 10 bucks a week. Yeah, that's 100, what's that? $120, right? That's pretty much my tithe for that month, right? Is that how it works? No. That's not what tithing is. Tithing is something that you do for yourself. God doesn't need your money, right? And because I've been playing games with God, I didn't realize the benefit of that to me, right? And so slowly but surely, God was calling me to himself in that area of my life. First thing that he does, within a month of me coming here to Fort McMurray, my cousin died suddenly in the Philippines. And very important, thing that happened in my life that was very shocking. And one of the things that I did to commemorate that was to adopt a child in compassion who had the same birthday as she did, right? So I adopted a child and I became faithful in that. Little things, $39 a month, that was it, right? And then little by little, God was building it up so that now I'm giving more than the 10%. Not trying to be, you know, this is what you should be doing. You need to decide within your own choices where you're going to be there. But slowly but surely, in that aspect of my life, God was calling me to greater and greater and greater and greater things. But he started out small, $39 a month. Not even close to a tithe there at that point, right? But he built it up. So God calls you. You obey, hopefully immediately, but surely God will not tempt you or call you beyond what you can understand. And finally, here's a really great and amazing thing about this story. Genesis 22. I'm actually just going to read it first real quick. So he did all of that. He saddled this donkey. He took his two young men. They started walking to the mountain. And so he saw that place afar. I'm on verse 5 if you're following. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." Right? This might be lost on us right now in the English. Right? But in the Hebrew, it's very clear here. Come again to you is in the plural. Come again to you. It's in the plural. So let me just go through that again real quick. What did he say? I and the boy will go over there. We'll go over there, plural. Why? Because I and the boy are the ones doing it. Right? We'll go over there and worship. Worship also in the plural. Why? I and the boy will be the ones doing the worshiping. Remember what the worshiping consists of. Killing and burning. And nevertheless, the next word right there. I and the boy will come back to you. Come again to you is in the plural. So here, what we have is Abraham believing even before Jesus has done it, believing in resurrection life. He believed the promise that God made. What was that? That Abraham, through his son Isaac, will become a nation as of a multitude like the stars. Right? Do you remember that story? God brought Abraham and saw, see the number of stars? That's how many nations you're going to have. That's how many descendants you're going to have. And that's going to happen through who? Through Isaac. It's going to happen through Isaac. And here, at this point, Isaac's not married. Isaac doesn't have kids. So Abraham needs to make sense of this thing that he's been asked to do. Now, I don't know exactly what it is that Abraham thought would happen. And I mean, it's a moot point, really, because again, God stopped him from killing Isaac. But whatever it is that Abraham thought, it's clear here in the text that Abraham believed that the promise was still legitimate, that the promise will still go on, and that that promise was going to be through Isaac. And here, if God is telling him that Isaac is going to be killed, then somehow resurrection must be the only thing. Now, I'm putting words in his mouth. But like I said, it's clear from the text. I and the boy will go over there. I and the boy will worship. I and the boy will come again to you. Resurrection life is key, is absolutely key to our worship of God. And it is really the thing, the fundamental thing that separates our worship of our God, our Creator God, from worship of idols and worship of anything else. The reason why we are even able to do that was because of a resurrection life that occurred 2,000 years ago. The resurrection life of Jesus Christ is what makes worship possible in the first place. And I think this is so great that today, in addition to having worship through song, one form of worship there, not the ultimate end all of worship, we were able to worship through song. We were able to worship through hearing the word. We were able to worship through prayer. And also, amazingly, we get to worship through celebrating the Lord's Supper, through remembering the sacrifice that Jesus made on the cross to save us from our sin. And so that, just as we enter into this time of remembrance, the Lord's Supper, that's what I want us to reflect on. Just think about what worship means to you. I don't know what you came in here with, what baggage you came in here with. I was kind of tossing and turning all night. I was a little sleepy when I came in here, and then thrown right on the piano playing. I don't know if you came here, maybe your kids were crying and just freaking out this morning. I don't know what it is. But here in this place, let's heed that call of God to come and worship and remember his cross. I'm going to call Daniel.